May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Rapucci. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. William Sandoval. This case comes to the court on the denial of a 35C motion. This is an extremely serious case. Mr. Sandoval is serving an indeterminate life sentence of 4 years to life under the Lifetime Supervision Act for a single count of child enticement. Because Mr. Sandoval continues to maintain his innocence, he has been denied treatment within the Department of Corrections to date, and thus has served 7 years at this point with no treatment whatsoever. And because he continues to maintain his innocence, this is likely to, in fact, be a determinate life sentence. And I bring this to the court's attention not to suggest that Mr. Sandoval is entitled to some sort of heightened review. He's not. But what he is entitled to is a meaningful opportunity to prove his claims. And that is what Mr. Sandoval was denied in this case. And the way he was denied this was that the trial court effectively took what was a well-planned, detailed, well-written, well-composed motion for post-conviction relief and whittled it down to a single claim. And in so doing, essentially eviscerated the overarching Strickland versus Washington claim. And so what I'm asking this court to do, first and foremost, is to remand this case to the trial court for latitude to present evidence on the claims that were denied, specifically the ones that I've detailed in the opening brief, in order to prove his claims. This court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly made clear to the trial courts of this state that Strickland versus Washington is a serious mandate and that post-conviction review is a critical stage in the proceedings. And there's been a trend over the past 10 years of summarily denying these motions or, in, as in case, this case shows, truncating them down to perhaps a single claim. And in this case, Bartolino and People versus Walton, there's other cases as well, but these cases make clear that when a post-conviction motion is properly pled, then the defendant is entitled to a full opportunity to prove his claims. And here, Mr. Sandoval was denied that opportunity.
So which claim?
As to particularly the three claims outlined in the opening brief, the first claim that he was denied one was ineffective assistance of counsel based on the failure to object in the elicitation of inadmissible and prejudicial testimony concerning Mr. Sandoval's prior conviction, one of Mr. Sandoval's prior convictions. And that was a conviction for vehicular assault. Now, that case was originally charged as vehicular homicide. Mr. Sandoval served 4 years in prison on that case. The basis of the claim is that the original charge, the homicide, as well as the 4 years imprisonment, are irrelevant and terribly prejudicial. They had no business being introduced in this case at all. And Section 1390.101 allows the prosecution to impeach through the use of a prior conviction. But that's the fact of a prior conviction. It's not a prior charge. It's not a prior sentence. And when this matter came up in the court, in the trial, it was during the Curtis advisement. And the prosecutor made clear that he was intending to elicit the original charge, the sentence, and the plea. Mr. Sandoval's trial counsel failed to object to this because he quite clearly did not recognize the law. Then, when Mr. Sandoval took the stand in his defense, counsel elicited from him the fact that he had been previously charged with a homicide, that he pled guilty to the assault, the vehicular assault, and that he had served 4 years in prison. This was inane and unreasonable. There is absolutely no reasonable strategic basis for the admission of this terribly prejudicial these facts that are terribly prejudicial. And in my supplemental authority, I've cited the case to the court to a federal, I believe it's a Third Circuit case, called Brake Iron versus Horn. It's a recent decision. And again, it's in my supplemental authority. What that case stands for, the proposition that on a federal habeas claim under the AEDPA, where Strickland claims are subject to double deference, which means that first, there's a deference to the trial court and its findings of fact, and second, in the federal court, you have to pass through a gateway of whether or not the state court decision is either contrary to clearly established law or an unreasonable application thereof. In that case, the federal habeas court found that even under that doubly deferential standard, that the defense counsel's failure to take corrective action to correct what had happened in voir dire, which was a statement by a member of the jury panel that the defendant used to do a lot of robbing. The defense lawyer in that case failed to recognize, apparently, the prejudice of that and did nothing to correct it.
Mr. Rappucci, in this case, we had, I guess, a curative instruction by the trial court. Why didn't that cure any alleged harm?
Well, 2 points. Brake Iron versus Horn makes clear that in some occasions, some circumstances, and I submit this is one of them, a curative instruction is not sufficient to cure the prejudice. But more importantly than that, the judge didn't give exactly a curative instruction. What the judge did was give a standard instruction on the use of a prior conviction for impeachment. What that instruction did not relate to and did not in any way limit the jury or direct the jury was what the jury was to do with the original charge, the homicide, or what the jury was to do with the prior prison sentence. And what we know the jury was supposed to do with those things is nothing. The jury shouldn't have been considering either of those facts at all. They were completely irrelevant. And this is a case, this case is not a case of overwhelming evidence by any means. This was a case of Mr. Sandoval's word versus the victim's word. It was a classic he said, she said case. And that's why, with regard to the three issues that I've highlighted in my briefs, what counsel did was, by failing to understand the law, failing to prepare for the trial, failing to meet with his client to prepare his client to testify, was remarkably successful at undermining his client's credibility.
Mr. Rappucci, how do we know that he failed to prepare his clients or that he even failed to meet with him?
Well, Your Honor, that's a perfect question, and you don't know that, and that is exactly why I'm requesting a remand. That is something that you should be able to look at, and you should know why. Mr. Sandoval should have been allowed to, one, testify to his meetings with his lawyer. Strickland makes very clear that one of the most important factors in assessing both prongs of Strickland is the client's communications with his attorney. Here, by limiting the evidentiary hearing to a single claim, the trial court substituted its belief that trial counsel had a reasonable basis to do these acts or omissions that I've pointed to. But there's no facts in the record to support that. And Arduino and Walton make very clear that that's the whole purpose of the evidentiary hearing. And so this court does not, I concede this court does not have some of the factual information that it needs to truly rule on this claim on the merits. And that's why I'm asking for a remand. Had the hearing not been so truncated to a single issue, Mr. Sandoval could have put on evidence from his own mouth or from expert witnesses concerning what the standards require, the standard in Adams County was at the time, what conversations he had with his lawyer, if any, any number of factual issues. So the appellate courts, and in fact the trial court, could actually have a factual basis on which to make its legal conclusions.
Isn't the trial court, and then, you know, if it comes back to us after the trial court considers these issues, but isn't it going to be disadvantaged by the fact that his trial counsel isn't there to defend himself, to either say, yes, I did meet with him, and these are all the times that I met with him, and this is what we talked about? you know, we have an attorney that is now deceased, right?
Sure. He may be disadvantaged in that. It depends on how you look at it. But the fact of the matter, the claim I just described, there's no reasonable basis for allowing your client, not preparing your client, and not objecting to a murder and a prison sentence. So what, in this particular instance, I don't think that it is a disadvantage. I think what the hearing would show is, would give some factual basis to what I'm trying to convey to the court, which...
Counsel, you're suggesting that the defendant brings 10 claims, one of which is entitled to a hearing, and the others can be resolved on the record or as a matter of law, that he's entitled to a hearing on all of them. Are you? You seem to be arguing that he should be able to bring evidence on all these claims in some sort of cumulative argument.
I am discussing a cumulative argument, but I'm not suggesting that claims that can be resolved fairly on the record should be part of that assessment. My point is that the claims I've discussed could not be fairly resolved on the record. And therefore, in this case, there was never a cumulative assessment. The trial court's final order says, oh, and by the way, I don't perceive cumulative prejudice. Well, of course you don't. You didn't have a hearing on these issues, so you don't know. So you can't truncate the hearing, deny a defendant an opportunity to present the factual basis and to prove his claim, and then turn around and say you didn't prove your claim. And in fact, that's what the people seem to be arguing in this case. Dunlap makes very clear that both prongs of Strickland are mixed questions of law and fact. In this case, we've got the judge just turning them into questions of law. And this case, I mean, it seems a little more fair because he got a hearing on one issue. But it's not. It's not fair because that was not the issue that, as it turns out, he could prove. The issues I'm talking about are the issues he can prove. There simply is no reasonable basis to allow evidence of a homicide and a prior prison sentence into the trial, and that's exactly what his lawyer did. And if I could save the remainder of my time for rebuttal, I would like to do that.
May it please the court, my name is Ryan Crane. I represent the people in this case. My attorney registration number is 37842. I'd like to start off just discussing what the actual standards are that we're discussing here. The defendant, of course, the arguments that he's raised here involve his request for a hearing. And in order to receive a hearing, he needs not only to state claims that, if proved at a hearing, would be true and would require reversal under the Strickland standards, he also needs to prove that they're not overcome by the record. That is, the trial court properly considered the trial transcripts and other portions of the record in this case when reviewing his claim. He has to establish under Strickland, he has to overcome with respect to performance, the presumption that under the circumstances, the challenged action might be considered sound trial strategy. As for prejudice, he has to prove that the result of the trial probably would have been different. When reviewing those claims, the trial court here, the district court reviewing the 35C motion, considers the trial transcript, not just what might have occurred later at a hearing. And that's my point being that it's not just that we have no information on these claims. The fact is that the trial court found no prejudice and no deficient performance considering the trial record itself.
Don't we review that de novo?
Which portion?
Any portion as to which defendant made an allegation and was not given a hearing?
Yes.
Okay, so to say the trial court found something is not a limiting factor on our review if there was no hearing supporting that finding?
I guess that's correct, yes.
Okay, what can you point to in the record that suggests it was a reasonable strategic choice to bring out the fact that Mr. Sandoval had been initially charged with vehicular homicide and to bring out the fact of the sentence that he served?
Well, as for that claim, I would state that I think the stronger case is there was no prejudice. But with respect, I did argue in the brief that there was no, and the trial court found also that there was no deficient performance in that respect. The reason I stated that and contend that is because I think the cases that he's talking about are factually distinct, and specifically because in this case, what the defendant was alleging as part of his defense was he didn't contact the police because he was very worried about this prior offense he had been through. The police, according to the testimony at trial, called and told his employer they were looking for the defendant because they were investigating a hit and run. Part of the defendant's defense, and this was important to his defense, was I didn't call the police back because I didn't know anything about my interaction with the victim here had ever happened, any of these allegations. I was completely surprised when I was arrested for child enticement. And the reason I didn't call the police back or didn't contact them at all was because they told my employer this was a hit and run, and I knew that I had a prior serious vehicular case on my record. And I think his words were, I was afraid that something was getting ready to happen to me that I had no part in doing.
Okay, why can't he tell that story just based on the vehicular assault conviction? Sure. As contrasted with embellishing it by what the original charge was?
It's a valid point. I guess the reason it might be considered a sound trial strategy here is because it makes it look like the defendant was vastly overcharged and it was this terrible experience for him where he ended up only with this vehicular assault conviction. I think honestly this point is resolved more strongly on the prejudice prong.
All right, let's talk about that.
Sure.
Doesn't this case resolve 100% to he said, she said?
Well, I mean,
there's no other witnesses were called. There's no physical evidence.
I wouldn't say
there's really no motive.
Right. I wouldn't say he said, she said, in the sense that there was no other corroborating evidence.
Okay, help me understand.
But yes, there's okay. No video of
what. Well, what other than the defendant was in the neighborhood, I guess in the neighborhood, because that's where he drives this other guy to work, mm-hmm. What corroborating evidence was there?
I guess, you know, looking at the motive of the victim and what she testified to and why she would have made this story up, there seemed to be no. Nothing that would, well, in my view, there was not a legitimate reason for her to go and just make this entire story up, having not seen the defendant in many years. The other corroborating evidence would be considered the defendant having dropped off his, I guess there was an explanation for why he was in the neighborhood, dropping off his coworker. His boss was able to confirm a few things about that he would have been in the neighborhood at the time. The victim went and talked to the school faculty afterwards and walked her brother's home, but then didn't tell her mother about it until later. So there were various circumstances. There's definitely no hard evidence, though, if that's the point that's being made.
You would concede this is not a case we can dispose of by saying the evidence against the defendant was overwhelming?
Probably not.
Thank you.
So the reason I think this is very clearly resolved, this particular claim on the prejudice prong, is that first of all, I want to point out the prison sentence itself was fairly minimal. The jury wasn't...
Life?
No, I'm sorry. No, absolutely not, Judge. The four-year prison sentence that he received on the prior conviction. And so the jury, without dispute, was going to hear that he was previously convicted of a felony, vehicular assault. What it would have imagined as the appropriate sentence or the likely sentence in that case, I don't know, but I would not be surprised if 4 years sounded like something lenient or at least not more prejudicial than the jury might have assumed absent having had that specific information brought to its attention.
And let's assume the defendant had been given an evidentiary hearing. Does he get to put on evidence of likely prejudice?
I don't see what kind of evidence you could put on. Perhaps there's studies of juries that exist that, you know, I really don't see what you would put on. I think trial courts make these kind of decisions all the time, as does this court. The other point with respect to prejudice is because the jury also was going to know about the vehicular assault conviction no matter what, the additional prejudice we're talking about is the prejudice from vehicular assault to vehicular homicide. It's just that it's not just that the jury was never going to know about a previous felony conviction involving a vehicular, for lack of a better word, assault of some sort. And so that's the only additional prejudice we're looking at. They don't necessarily know that. They know that the initial charge was vehicular homicide.
You can't charge vehicular homicide without somebody dying, can you?
I don't know what went through the jury's head. They might have imagined that, the charge was reduced because the victim lived or something like that, or he only got 4 years because this ended up not being a homicide. I don't know what the jury would have imagined.
It's a homicide.
I don't know.
I would doubt he would have gotten 4 years for vehicular assault if it was a first offense.
Probably true.
The DAs have a lot of discretion.
Absolutely.
In the state, but I don't think they can charge somebody with a homicide when nobody died.
I just don't know to what degree the jury would have understand the particulars of how charges and plea bargains work. That's my only point in that respect. And so, as I also pointed out, the previous offense actually was not related to the nature of the offense and allegations in this case. You've got a traffic case previously. Here we're talking about, allegations of essentially attempted kidnapping or attempted sexual assault on a child. His previous offense was not a sexual assault on a child. It wasn't contributing to the delinquency of a minor. That I wanted to point out. Honestly, I think the limiting instruction is the most important point, and that's because even if he had been convicted of a previous vehicular homicide, we would trust that the jury would have heeded the trial court's limiting instruction. There's not additional prejudice that the jury could not have set aside if it had been any different if he had actually been convicted of vehicular homicide in the prior case.
But the stock instruction goes to the prior conviction. It doesn't tell the jury anything about what it's supposed to do, having heard the sentence or having heard that there was a much more serious original charge, correct?
That is correct, Judge, but especially because the way that prior charge and sentence were introduced in this case, all as sort of one event, the charge, you were convicted of this, you were charged with this, you got this sentence. I think the jury would have understood that instruction as dealing with the prior conviction, quote unquote, as a whole.
Mr. Crane, your opponent makes a fair statement or a fair point that given the trial court never afforded the defendant a hearing on the other grounds, including this issue of the prior felony, and we don't even have enough information to make a decision on that issue. How do you address that?
Well, I don't know what else the trial, and I guess are you referring specifically to the idea that the defense lawyer might not have properly prepared the defendant for?
Yeah, I mean, the defendant is contending that, he didn't meet enough with his lawyer. His mm-hmm. lawyer didn't, get him ready to just talk about the conviction itself as opposed to, where they started and how he pled and what his sentence was.
Right, because the defendant's answer was non-responsive when he mentioned the prior charge. He brought it up himself, and so I actually don't know for sure if that point, that improper preparation, was raised in the 35C and before the trial court. And I'm not saying it was or it wasn't. I just, off the top of my head, I don't remember that. That is something that without trial counsel, I guess we could have had the defendant's testimony about what happened. But as I said, I think this point is most easily resolved on the prejudice ground. And that, I don't think we would have had anything added help, anything additional added of substance at a hearing.
Let me ask you this. If the trial court in determining without a hearing denied some of these claims, and he did so based on lack of prejudice?
I think the trial court cited both grounds for all of the claims. But
pardon?
I think the trial court cited both grounds for its denial of all of the claims without a hearing.
Lack of prejudice. Wouldn't the trial court have to take that into account in determining this particular one or others? In other words, there's cumulative prejudice.
Right, the cumulative argument.
There's not cumulative ineffectiveness, but there is cumulative prejudice.
I suppose it could have been considered. My understanding of cumulative prejudice is it's got to be something outside of just, there's got to be some reason that the errors contribute in a way that wasn't just, that it shouldn't just be analyzed as individual errors. Just adding them up to me, it doesn't seem like that should call for a wholly different type of analysis. If they were somehow related in the sense of, I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but if they were, if somehow one of them kind of like multiplied the prejudice of the other one so seriously that it could really bring something else to bear on the prejudice analysis as a whole, that might be appropriate. In this case, I don't see the relation between the two alleged.
Well, the straw that broke the camel's back doesn't fit here.
I don't.
Or it doesn't fit in this context.
It doesn't, and maybe the best way to address that is the claim on which the trial court did have a hearing. To me, it's very clear that there was neither deficient performance nor prejudice. So I don't think there was any prejudice to accumulate with that claim on which there was a hearing. That failing to call that eyewitness, alleged eyewitness William Pacheco was ended up being. I think the trial court's findings were very, very justified.
Finding of a lack of prejudice, really sort of a finding that there's insufficient prejudice. I mean, this
wouldn't have caused the jury to convict, The jury with this, without this, would have still convicted. That's right. Basically what we're saying.
I see.
But you start adding them up.
That is a legitimate point. I think it probably doesn't apply, at least with respect to the claim that was addressed at the hearing, because the trial court actually found, and I think it's amply justified by the record, is that if anything, this witness would have hurt the defense. He was so unbelievable. His not only did his story not corroborate anything the defendant said, his testimony was so unbelievable and so subject to change upon challenge that it actually would have undermined the defense and make the victim look that much better. So I think that while that may be a valid analytical point, sometimes I don't think it applies in this case. Well, if the court has no further questions, I'd like to ask that the order be affirmed, and I will thank the court for its time.
The fact that we're talking about what the jury's imagination may have been and whether or not what they would have thought about this sentence and this the prison sentence and the homicide highlights both prongs of Strickland. The fact of the matter is the jury shouldn't have been thinking about a homicide at all. It shouldn't have been thinking how much time Mr. Sandoval spent in prison, and whether they would have discounted that or done what a lot of the Colorado case law, and in fact the United States Supreme Court case law in Old Chief, and Colorado case law is Goldsberry and Lucero and Stahl, it talks about the damning innuendo that prior criminality casts on a defendant and how it affects a jury. And a lot of those cases make the point, and I think that perhaps Colorado law has retreated a little bit from that, but they make the point that these are bells that can't be unrung. And even with, I think it's Lucero that makes the point, and these cases are all cited in the reply brief. But again, I'd cite the court back to Brakeiron versus Horn because it makes exactly the same point, which I've made with those cases, which is we're really underestimating the prejudice that this could have on a jury. And the jury has now gone from trying to decide whether or not Mr. Sandoval's credibility is impacted by his prior felony for vehicular assault to wondering whether Mr. Sandoval's a murderer, whether Mr. Sandoval's an ex-con. And these are the other claims that I'm not going to get a chance to talk about today, but there's two more outlined in the brief. Together, what happens here is that trial counsel is remarkably effective at undermining his own client's credibility. And in this case, that is what gives rise to a reasonable probability of a different result. And of course, this court's very familiar with Strickland, as am I. And I've read that case probably 50 to 100 times, and it never ceases to amaze me. It's an incredibly complicated decision, and it's an incredibly deep decision. And Strickland does make the point that you do accumulate the prejudice. You do accumulate the different instances. And I can't remember the exact quote, but I can give the court the exact cite. It's page 695 to 696. And what the language is that taking the unaffected errors as a given, something along those lines, and then taking due account of the errors, The question becomes whether or not the court's confidence is undermined. And the errors that I'm talking about here, and the errors that Mr. Sandoval did not get to prove, these are all errors that do and should undermine the court's confidence. There's the evidence of prior criminality. There's also the defense attorneys eliciting the fact that Mr. Sandoval had both hired an attorney and remained silent with the police, neither one of which had any place in this trial. He elicited those as well, and in fact rendered what would have been a harmful error on direct appeal, turned it into a harmless error on direct appeal.
Argue them, yeah.
The third one is the statement, I've been wanting you since your auntie's house. And that deals with prior consistent versus inconsistent statements and whether or not that statement would have been admissible. I appreciate the court's time and indulgence. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments and briefs. The case will be deemed submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. The division will